Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I think it's a fairly exciting time in the Scottish countryside right now. I think the things are beginning to change. One of the things that's happened over the last few years has been the reintroduction of the first mammal to the Scottish countryside, the beaver. And I was down searching for those a couple of days ago, unsuccessfully, I have to say. And another change that's happened very recently, which I think marks an important stage in Scotland's evolution, I hope, is that mountain hares became a protected species, which I must admit I didn't think I'd see for a long time. So one of the things that one of the creatures that I would really like to see reintroduced back into the Scottish countryside is the lynx. And my guest today is David Hetherington, who's I think it's fair to say, an authority on that animal. And I just brought along David to maybe talk about what's happening with the lynx and where we might be going. Hello, David.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm fine. Maybe it would be a good idea to start if you could, for people who aren't familiar with the lynx, because I remember when I first heard about the possibility of reintroducing the lynx, I didn't even know they were native species to Britain. What are lynx? Tell us a little bit about them, if you wouldn't mind describing them.
So the lynx is a group of medium-sized cat that's found in both North America and Eurasia. There's actually four different species. So in North America, you've got the Canada lynx that lives in Alaska and Canada and into the US Rockies. And you've got the bobcat, which is found in southern Canada, right through the United States into Mexico. Here on this side of the Atlantic, we've got two species of lynx. We've got the Iberian lynx, which some of your listeners might know is a very rare and endangered species found in Spain and Portugal. And then the Eurasian lynx, which has a much wider geographical distribution from Western Europe all the way over to the Pacific coast of Russia. And down to the Middle East and the Himalayas, and was once found here in the British Isles. Of those four species, the Eurasian lynx is by far and away the biggest. They all have the similar body plan. They've all got these distinctive tufted ears and short stubby tails and quite often spotted coats. But yeah, the major difference is that Eurasian lynx is quite a bit bigger than the other three, and that's reflected in its diet. The other three tend to feed on small mammals and rabbits and hares, that sort of thing, whereas the Eurasian lynx is a big game hunter, and it especially likes roe deer. Mm-hmm. So it's a solitary animal, very low density. You never get very many lynx in a landscape. It needs a large home range or territory in order to get what it needs out of the landscape, which is typically, like I say, small to medium sized woodland deer, especially roe deer.
Right, it's a strange thing in a way, but the lynx seem to have slipped out of our communal memory, really, because there are no real stories about lynx, are there?
No, that's a good observation, that, John. I guess if we all think about the kind of morality tales and fairy stories that we grew up with as children, you know, there's plenty of stories about bears, you know, the three bears and Goldilocks, uh-huh. Of course. And wolves, gosh, there's umpteen stories about wolves, and they're usually cast as the baddie. And of course, when it comes to lynx, you know, the third of that kind of trio of large carnivores that were typically found across Europe, there is nothing. You know, the cultural associations with lynx are generally pretty tenuous and weak, and certainly in British culture, there's very little, if any, connection between you know, people and that species. It is a bit of a forgotten species, and certainly compared to those other two species, it's not just the, you know, the tales and the stories. It's, you know, depictions and art, place names. There's much fewer references to lynx than there are to those other two species, and I think a lot of that has probably got to do with the very secretive, cryptic behaviour of lynx. They're a very shy and elusive animal. That I think it's just very difficult for people to interact with them, to observe. And actually, I think also, perhaps because they're in some ways the more benign of the three species, they're not really perceived as a threat to human safety in the way that wolves and bears perhaps have been. So we've tended to sort of laud them a little bit less in our cultural background.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as I said at the outset, you know, beaver have been reintroduced, and beaver are very different from lynx in the sense that beaver sort of almost advertise their presence in a landscape. You can't miss it. They bring down trees and build dams, and you know that there are beaver about. Whereas lynx could be in a landscape in Scotland, for example. I think you probably would never see them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, as you say, beavers tend to be pretty obvious, especially if you know what you're looking for. You know, chop down trees and dams and burrowing into to banks and whatnot, building lodges. Yeah, they are pretty obvious. Lynx, yeah, completely the opposite. It's you'd really need to know what you're looking for and have a great deal of luck, even to find the field signs of lynx. You know, to find the footprints, to find the droppings, but to see the animal itself, gosh, yeah. That is, you know, you kind of hit the jackpot there. I mean, I have seen lynx in the wild, in the mountains of Switzerland and in the Alps, but I had a technological advantage. You know, the lynx that I was tracking had a radio collar on, and we had an antenna, so we knew, roughly speaking, where it was. But even then, you know, those guys who were following those lynx around the mountains for months and months and months, you know, they very rarely, if ever, saw the lynx that they were following. They were basically trying to sort of move around the landscape, you know, these researchers, and triangulate to try and get a rough location of where the lynx was in the landscape, but they very rarely ever saw them. And I was just very fortunate that myself and the guy I was with, we did happen to see it. We had lost the signal. It was bouncing off you know, steep cliff faces. And so it was a bit confusing for a while. We just didn't know where this lynx was. We couldn't get a signal at all. And then suddenly, we got a really strong signal, and the guy I was with said, look, I think he's on the other side of that gully in amongst the trees, about 100 metres away. So let's just, you know, take our rucksacks off, get our binoculars out and scan through those trees and see if we can find him. And I thought, I don't fancy our chances here of seeing this thing. You know, it's mm-hmm. you know, lots of dappled, you know, sunlight and trees and leaves on the other side of this gully. But sure enough, after about a minute or two, there was this little lynx face just watching us through a gap in the shrubbery from 100 meters away. And you know what? The hair in the back of my neck still goes up. Even now, as I'm recounting this story, the hair is going up in the back of my neck. And it did at the time. It was just quite an astounding feeling, knowing that you're being watched by a wild animal, particularly, I guess, a predator, although, you know, lynx aren't really a threat to human safety. But there was something really quite awe-inspiring about that moment, and it's a memory that will live with me forever. But yeah, that is something, it really struck a chord with me, because I thought, well, if we hadn't known to look in that direction because of the technology we had, we would have had no idea that we were being watched by a large carnivore. And it makes you think, well, how many times when we go out for a walk in the countryside are we actually being watched by wildlife that we have no idea, because we just don't have the senses to make us aware of that?
Yeah, I think it's a very special feeling being in the landscape with one of these sort of iconic creatures. One of the things I did fairly recently was I went to James Roddy's hide on the Black Isle, and had a sort of fairly close encounter with a pine marten, which pine marten are obviously a lot more common than lynx. Well, lynx, there aren't any lynx, but that was a special thing, to be that close to a wild animal. How long ago were lynx native to the British Isles then? How long have they been extinct, I guess I'm asking?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting subject. I mean, I think until fairly recently, I think we've known for quite a while that we've had lynx, because their bones have been found in various caves the length and breadth of Britain, and in fact one site in Ireland as well. So we knew we had them, but for a long time they would have assumed to have died out many thousands of years ago. And in fact, their bones have been found in the bone caves near Inchnadamph in northwest Sutherland. And actually, there was a skull came out of that cave that was in really good nick. And in fact, it's on display in the National Museums of Scotland in Chambers Street in Edinburgh. And because it was in good nick, it was assumed to be the most recent lynx bone in Britain. And because of some charcoal layers that it was sitting nearby, that I think had been dated to the Neolithic era, it was assumed that this skull was, you know, approximately 4,000 years old. So there were quite a lot of assumptions being made there along that storyline there. But, and therefore they came to the conclusion that lynx died out 4,000 years ago. And because round about then there had been a period of natural climate change when the climate got sort of wetter and cooler, the conclusion was that lynx had died out in Britain because of natural climate change. Mm-hmm. So I would say quite a sugary narrative there in many ways, but it was kind of blown out of the water in the late 1990s when those lynx remains were carbon dated and found not to be 4,000 years old, but found to be only 1,800 years old. Oh, so putting them, I suppose, into the Roman era. And that significantly postdates any period of natural climate change. And so now you're looking at their extinction probably having been caused by human causes. But of course, one carbon date is a little bit insecure, I would say. But then there has also been some lynx remains found in bone caves in North Yorkshire, for example. And I was involved in a project to carbon date them. One of them was about 1,800 years old, so Roman era, but one of them was actually post-Roman, early medieval period, about 1,500 years old. So again, we're strengthening the case for lynx having survived much more recently, mm-hmm. and therefore human agency having been responsible for them. And also, I think that those carbon dates help us look at some of the cultural evidence that I think may have been overlooked or forgotten for traces of lynx surviving more recently in Britain. And when you start to do that, you start to find the kind of faint traces of them in the cultural record. Early medieval Welsh poetry talking about the hunting of lynx in the Lake District. References in the writings of Bede to beasts, black lions, I think they were referred to, mm-hmm. taking the shepherd's flock at night time. Black, I suppose, being used in the sense of malevolent and evil rather than necessarily coloration.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's one place name from Shropshire in England that means the ford of the lynx. There seems to be a word in the early Gaelic language, as it was before it became the more modern Gaelic language, that talks about lynx and lynx-like leaping. And then I think when I was researching my recent book, I found a reference in 15th century Welsh poetry to an animal called the Llobrich, which literally means the speckled lion. And this speckled lion in the poem was described as moving up into the hills of North Wales in the summer times, following the roe deer as the roe deer moves higher up into the mountains.
Oh, right. Okay.
Growth. And I thought, wow, that's a fantastic bit of cultural record there. The speckled lion in North Wales, well, what on earth else could that be? And here it is actually describing natural behaviour of the lynx following roe deer up into the mountains. So I thought, well, if they're in North Wales in the 15th century, they're almost certainly in the Scottish Highlands at the same time, and quite probably for a little bit later, because the Scottish Highlands have tended to act. As a bit of a last bastion for a lot of predatory species, whether it's golden eagles and ospreys or wolves and pine martens.
Sure.
So I think it stands to reason that the lynx probably made its last stand in the Highlands too, and could have done so until maybe the 15th, 16th century.
Right. So not that far back, really. And I think we first talked about, I first met you and we talked about lynx when I was researching for my book, Skydance, which was really my attempt, I suppose, to bring lynx to the public imagination. Where do you think we are in terms of there are now a lot of people, I think, who would like to see the lynx back. Where are we right now in terms of the possibility of lynx being reintroduced to Scotland?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that we've certainly, the discussion about lynx as a former native species and as a potential candidate for reintroduction in Scotland and indeed elsewhere in the UK has really mushroomed in the last 10 to 15 mm-hmm, years. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, we weren't really talking, there was no real discussion happening about lynx reintroduction in the UK. The focus was on beavers, but also on wolves. Because, of course, in the mid-1990s, our Anglophonic cousins on the other side of the Atlantic in the US were reintroducing rules to Yellowstone, and that was garnering quite a lot of press and public attention. And at the time, there was a bit of a discussion going on about, you know, managing deer impacts in the Highlands. So that led to, I think, quite a groundswell of interest in the idea of reintroducing wolves to Scotland. At that time, I was kind of looking at this thinking, I can imagine all sorts of problems and conflicts about reintroducing wolves to Scotland, but nobody's talking about lynx, which I knew to have been native to Scotland, but seemed to cause far fewer problems, far fewer conflicts. Yeah. And then so I went on to do my PhD at the University of Aberdeen, exploring the feasibility of lynx reintroduction. I was fortunate to get some funding together, largely from the Roy Dennis Wildlife Foundation. And that allowed me to look at the historical occurrence of lynx and the possible reasons for why they became extinct. I then modelled, well, do we have enough suitable and connected habitat with enough prey in that habitat to support a minimum viable population of lynx in modern Scotland.
Right.
And so that is what I investigated. I then published the results of that in various peer-reviewed papers and started, I suppose, to communicate the science. And I think that helped perhaps get the idea of lynx as a former native and as a reintroduction candidate out there a few years back. And I think that's continued to grow. And we are seeing now several NGOs across the UK, so not just in Scotland, now talking very publicly about reintroducing lynx to various landscapes in Scotland. We still, as you know, we haven't seen a reintroduction project happening yet. There was an application to do a trial reintroduction in Kielder Forest, just over the border in Northumberland, but that was rejected by the government in England about 2 years ago. But every so often we do see press reports about an NGO trying to release them in Wales or Thetford Forest in Norfolk or somewhere in Scotland. So it does keep popping up. And that's kind of where we're at the moment. And I suppose my own feeling about all of this is actually, as a nation, we in Scotland and indeed elsewhere in the UK, we actually know very little about this species. If we're going to have a national discussion about reintroducing it, we need to understand it much better. Because as an observer, what I've noticed, and this is completely understandable, of course, is that people fill the knowledge gaps with assumptions. And 90 out of 10, those assumptions tend to be incorrect. So people describe how they believe a lynx lives and how it hunts and how it interacts. And you're listening to it. And what they're actually describing unwittingly is a wolf. You know, they're describing how lynx are going to run around the landscape, you know, chasing flocks of sheep and in open pastures, and that's just not what lynx do. It may well be what wolves do, and they typically do things like that in various other countries, but it's not what lynx do. So I think for me, one of the potentially biggest barriers to successful lynx reintroduction is widespread misunderstanding about what a lynx is, how it behaves, and how it interacts with us and our economic activities in the countryside.
Yes, it contrasts really with a beaver, and obviously, nobody thinks they're going to be attacked by a beaver, and no one thinks a beaver is going to take livestock and that sort of thing. But obviously, when you're introducing a carnivore, there are I think more barriers perhaps in the public imagination. How do you think that suppose there were lynx wild in the Highlands, for example, how do you think what impact do you think they would have on basically our activities on farming or on our leisure activities?
I think in terms of our leisure activities, they're going to have very little negative impact. This is not a species that is dangerous to people, unless in the very unlikely event, a lynx would have rabies. There have been one or two cases from Eastern Europe over the last few decades where rabid lynx have caused a bit of a problem and have approached people and attacked them. But that's very unusual circumstances. Of course, if we're talking about reintroducing animals to the UK, then they wouldn't have rabies, of course. So they don't approach people. And I think, I guess people would need to be reassured that they're not a physical threat to them. Actually, the number one conflict, and this I think is probably a little bit surprising for a UK audience, the number one conflict between people and lynx in modern Europe is actually about deer. I think we automatically assume it's going to be about livestock, but it's actually about deer. And that, of course, is because, you know, day in, day out, you know, lynx are killing deer. That's what they do. Every lynx is hunting deer if it can do that. And in most European countries, compared to the UK, you know, hunting is quite a popular activity. So by comparison, for example, in Norway, you're 60 times more likely per head of population to hunt deer than you are if you're from the UK.
Right, right.
Norway...
Sorry, I'm just going to clarify. Are you talking about red deer here?
No, just deer in general.
Okay.
I mean, the hunting of deer is not a widespread activity in British society. I mean, certainly it goes on, of course, but in terms of a proportion of the population undertake it, it's actually a very small proportion. And hunting, like I say, tends to be pursued by a greater proportion of the population elsewhere in Europe. And very often in those countries, they've got fewer deer than perhaps we have here in the UK. So, for example, like I say, in Norway, it's 60 times more likely to be a deer hunter in Norway, but actually they've got far fewer deer. So the scope for conflict between human hunters of deer and lynx is much greater. And we tend to find that there is a conflict right across the board, across many European countries. The conflict around livestock, on the other hand, it's far from uniform. There are plenty of countries where there is no conflict between lynx and, for example, sheep, because they don't have them in the same landscape together, or because they use traditional livestock, either herding or guarding techniques.
Right.
You know, intensive shepherding or using livestock guarding animals such as dogs, or even things like donkeys and llamas can actually be trained to protect sheep against things like lynx. And so, in many countries, you talk about, you know, lynx killing sheep, and they'll look at you like you're crazy. Well, no, lynx don't kill sheep. Wolves and bears do, but lynx don't.
Right.
But as in other parts of Europe, they may well have more of an issue. And again, it won't be a widespread issue. It'll be that one or two lynx are taking some sheep now and then. And that's the typical pattern in places further west. So, uh-huh. Places like France and Germany and Switzerland, where lynx have been reintroduced in the last few decades, after an absence of perhaps a century or two. And so people have given up on the traditional livestock guarding because they've lost their bears, their wolves and their lynx, so they don't need to do it anymore. But then the carnivores come back and find, you know, unguarded sheep free-ranging in the landscape. So there's a greater vulnerability there, and some sheep get taken by some lynx now and then, but the vast right. majority of the lynx population aren't taking lynx. The major difference or the scenario that's very different from that and the complete opposite one that I described from Eastern Europe, where they talk, you know, where they're still doing that traditional guarding and shepherding in places like Romania and Slovakia, is Norway. Norway has by far and away the worst case scenario for the relationship between lynx and sheep. And actually, people who are opposed to the idea of lynx reintroduction in the UK are very quick to use Norway as a case study and say, hey, look, this is what happens in Norway. This would happen here. And the reason why Norway is so much worse than anywhere else in Europe is because not only do they not shepherd their sheep intensively or guard them with guarding animals like they do in French and other parts of Western Europe, but they're actually grazing them in woodland habitat, which of course is where the lynx live. Lynx are an ambush hunter, so they need to be in cover to launch a surprise attack on an animal, typically a roe deer, and so they tend to be found largely in woodland environments, and that's where the Norwegians are grazing 2.5 million sheep every year. In a landscape where roe deer are actually, relative to the UK certainly, pretty scarce. So they're much more likely to encounter sheep, particularly in the summer months, than they are roe deer. Despite that, they're still hunting roe deer way more than they are sheep. But it seems that compared to anywhere else in Europe, more lynx have got access to more sheep, and more sheep killing takes place. So that's the sort of potential issues that we might face in Scotland. I suspect a conflict around competition for deer would be much less intense in Scotland than it is in other European countries, simply because we have fewer people shooting deer and we have an awful lot of deer. we have, in the UK as a whole, we've got an awful lot of sheep. I mean, we have more sheep than any other European country. Although, I mean, who knows how that's going to pan out in the years to come as we
move exactly.
to common agricultural policy. So I would say the greatest potential conflict in Scotland is likely to be around livestock. But of course, the vast majority of Scottish sheep are not grazed in woodland. And the vast majority of our woodlands contain no sheep. So I think what we're likely to see in Scotland is a model much more akin to what happens in Western, other parts of Western Europe, not Norway. It's not going to be the same as Eastern Europe because we don't do the intensive shepherding and the livestock guarding, although that can be done where you've got a bit of an issue, and that certainly is being done in some of those Western European countries where they felt they've had an issue. They've taken those traditional methods back in, and it has been very effective. So, but I suspect what we would see in Scotland is a situation similar to, say, France or Switzerland, where one or two lynx occasionally take sheep now and then. But in Switzerland, they deal with that by issuing a license to a state game warden to shoot a problem lynx.
A problem lynx is a lynx
that kills 15 sheep in a year. And they haven't actually haven't had to authorize one of those licenses since 2003. Which gives you some idea of how infrequent sheep killing by lynx in a situation where lynx, where sheep are grazed in open pastures rather than woodland is.
Right. I mean, so basically, I suppose what you're saying is that, that essentially lynx live in forests and woodland and are not going to be coming out into fields to hunt sheep unless there's a unusually, I suppose, sheep stray close to the periphery of a forest and are sort of come into contact with lynx that way. But it doesn't sound to be a huge issue. What do you see as the next move, next step to the, for the reintroduction of lynx then?
Well,
if I can ask you that.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely growing NGO interest, and there are various NGOs who are interested in this. Like, and I mentioned them before, there's been one NGO that's been involved in putting forward a case for Kielder. I noticed they've been in the media again this week suggesting the Trossachs.
There are,
however, other... I think there are other NGOs that perhaps larger NGOs that are more well-known and have more resources that are certainly interested in lynx reintroduction. And I think they feel that perhaps conducting lynx reintroduction via the media is probably not the best way to do it. Perhaps, I think, moving at a sort of more softly, more slowly pace. So I would anticipate, you know, that things will certainly move on the subject of lynx in the next couple of years. Whether we see the return of lynx anytime soon, of course, remains to be seen. I think that's a very difficult thing to predict, and I think it has to be subject to a very sensitive and respectful national discussion and dialogue, where I think the concerns and wishes of people who manage the countryside have to be listened to and respected. But, you know, if people are willing to have a respectful dialogue and perhaps, you know, compromise a little bit on things, then it may well be achievable in the years to come.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. And I think, obviously, if people want to find out more about lynx, then they can get themselves a copy of your book, The Lynx and Us, which is, I'll put links to that on the page for this podcast. And they might even enjoy reading my book, which talks about lynx in a rather more humorous way.
The idea with the book was really to, I suppose, take all the kind of scientific knowledge from across Europe and repackage that in a fairly digestible and easily understandable way. Accompanied by, I have to say, some sumptuous photography by my colleague Laurent Gillin, a French photographer who works in the mountains of Switzerland and who I would argue has got the finest portfolio of wild lynx images out there. So it certainly is a beautiful book, and I can say that because I didn't take any of the photographs and I didn't design the layout, but it's a very sumptuous book, and, you know, great present for anybody who's interested in this sort of thing.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I was keen to take that scientific knowledge and give a really impartial and balanced account of what it means for links and people to share landscapes, because I think that's it is important for people to understand the species if we're going to have a national discussion about it.
Well, that's right. And I think your book was a really significant step forward in terms of links reintroduction. Fundamentally, I think it's about education. And it's about people understanding the links and understanding the links in the context of the role that it could play in our countryside. And I think your book, you know, took that forward.
Yeah, it may well have done or continue to do so. Like I say, I think that national discussion is certainly going to continue to grow. And it is very easy for the information that's put out there by proponents to be overly optimistic, and the information put out by critics to be overly pessimistic. And of course, the truth lies somewhere in between. You know, lynx are not angels. Beavers are not angels. You know, many of these animals that we've got rid of do have impacts on land management activities.
Absolutely,
we need to be honest about that. But there are ways, of course, of managing those impacts. And very often the impacts are not quite as bad as are often portrayed.
Right.
You know, if they can have links in the Jura Mountains of Switzerland, where there's 120 people per square kilometre, and lots of roads and towns and villages, and lots of people using that landscape intensively at weekends to go, you know, to do outdoor recreation, they can do it in a landscape that's 120 people per square kilometre. It makes you think, well, okay, Scottish Highlands, well, Highland Region, for example, has a human population density of 9 people per square kilometre.
Yes.
So lynx can certainly live in some very busy human-modified environments right across Western Europe where they have been reintroduced. So, you know, it's certainly possible.
Yes, I certainly hope that it's something that we see progress soon. It is possible, and I think it would be a great thing to have a creature like that living wild with us. You know, it's part of our heritage, really, and something that I really do hope we can get back, certainly in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Okay, David, thanks very much. That's absolutely been fascinating, and I'll put links to your book on my page. Thanks very much for talking to me.
Well, thanks for having me on, John. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome. Thanks then. Bye-bye.
Cheers.